Welcome, my friends, to the Sage Equate Radio Hour, your home for free and critical thinking, and I'm your host, Mike Williams. Tonight, Deanna Spingola returns to the show. Deanna is an author, researcher, and radio host. She investigates government and corporate corruption as it relates to the faltering liberties of American citizens and the war-targeted populations of other countries. And as you will hear in this interview, Deanna does not shy away from controversial issues. Deanna's recent books include her Ruling Elite trilogy, along with her newest book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. In our discussion tonight, Deanna will take us through how the Jewish constructs of Zionism and communism has intentionally and systematically subverted and corrupted the Republic of the United States. For many, some of what you will hear in this show will be controversial because this is a version of history you have never been made aware of. It is, for all intents and purposes, suppressed knowledge. And to kick the show off, I asked Deanna to explain Zionism, and here is what she had to say. Deanna, when I have conversations with folks about Zionism, and I try to explain what Zionism is, and typically I get a lot of blank stares, because either A, they have never heard of Zionism, or they have heard about it, but they equate it with Israel, they equate it with Judaism, therefore there's no reason to look any further than that. So I was wondering for today's show, because I know you know a lot about this topic, if you can just tell us a little bit about what exactly is Zionism and what is its ideology and what is Zionism striving for?
Well, initially, the early Zionists were really intent on returning the ethnic group, ethnic religious group known as the Jews to Palestine. And it started quite early, and some of the early Zionists were actually British, and it was due to their efforts that the earlier Jews, beginning probably in about 1870, were actually they went to Palestine. You don't have to be a Zionist. In other words, there are a lot of people who are Zionist who are not Jewish. They're called neocons and they're called all kinds of things. But they have a lot of helpers. It isn't just a Jewish movement. It is a Zionist movement perpetuated by a lot of churches here in America, which is kind of interesting because a lot of churches believe and a lot of church leaders believe that the Jews are supposed to have this land that somehow 2,000 years ago, that God promised them, that they could have this land. And it's quite a big stretch of land. So anyway, they have a lot of helpers. And if they didn't have all of this assistance, they probably would not, well, I know for sure that they would not have been successful in seizing the land, that was inhabited by a group of people, by people, a population that had been there for decades and decades, hundreds of years.
Right.
And without the help, the military help, the philosophical help, and the economic help, they would not have been successful. So they certainly did not do it themselves. And it's interesting that inasmuch as they feel that God chose them and gave them this land, then why did they need all of this help? Why did they need to destroy cities, at least 500 cities, towns in Palestine that were inhabited, all the farmland that was inhabited, all the orchards that were inhabited? They needed the military help. Because, well, quite frankly, it was an invasion of a country, an area that was already inhabited. And, of course, prior to the time that the British entered the picture, it was under the jurisdiction of the Ottoman Empire, which also had to be destroyed. I mean, if you look at all the warfare surrounding these efforts, the Khazar efforts of obtaining this land, I mean, millions of people died.
Well, this is very interesting because you mentioned the Khazars, and I'm glad you did that. So there will be an argument by many that will say that since they are Khazars, which means they are from the Khazarian Empire, which is in Europe, that they really have no claim, whether it be religious, legal, on any basis, to the land in the Middle East.
Exactly. They are not ethnically connected to the land in the Middle East. There's no genetic connection to Palestine or to Abraham. And these are, we're referring to Eastern European Jews. They are not Semitic. And there's been a lot of documentation that confirms this. There's been a lot of revisionist studies and books such as The 13th Tribe by author Arthur Koestler, K-O-E-S-T-L-E-R, and he was Jewish. And then there was the Ashkenazic Jews, a Slavo-Turkic people in search of a Jewish identity by Paul Wexler. There's also The Jews of Khazaria by Kevin A. Brook. And more recently, The Invention of the Jewish People by Shlomo Sand. Now, I mean, these are people who obviously are interested in this and, well, Jewish. They're Jewish people. Some of them are Jews. And they have presented evidence that suggests, that confirms that these people are not Semitic. They have no right to the land. And of course, then there's the biblical reference of the Jews who call them, the people who call themselves Jews, who are not. Christ referred to these people as the synagogue of Satan in the New Testament. So I mean, there's not only biblical evidence, but certainly more modern evidence in the books that I cited. And in fact, Kevin A. Brook has an online presence and an essay regarding the origination of the Eastern European Jews. And this also includes opinions from other historians, and they favor the Khazar theory. Now, a lot of people will not accept that theory, but even if you look in the early Jewish writings, say from 1900, they pretty much indicate that these people are not who they say they are.
You can't even find any references to the Khazarian Empire. If you go back into any history books, I'm talking about current day history books. It's just not there. It's just not talked about. In fact, one of the ways I found out about this was I started reading and listening to Benjamin Friedman's research.
Oh, yes.
And Benjamin Friedman goes back, I guess, to the 40s and 50s when he really started to put this forward and explain that they are Khazars.
Right.
That they had adopted Judaism. They are not indigenous to the Middle East. And so I found his work very, very informative. And that's where I started. And I think, I'm trying to remember now when I read some of his material, I think he was doing some presentation. It might have been at the Pentagon or something to that effect.
And
he gave his entire presentation, and then he said that there was a colonel that had come up to him, and I guess the colonel was responsible for some educational courses or some curriculum at the military. And he said to him, you know, he says, I'm so glad that you spoke today. I'm paraphrasing, folks, okay? But he said to Benjamin Friedman, until today, I have never, ever heard of the Khazars, which I found extraordinary, right? I mean, the whole military-industrial complex, at the end of the day, is in support of the Zionist Khazarian agenda.
And they're really, well, supposedly they are descendants of Judah, one of the 12 tribes of Israel. But they were warlike, they were violent, they originated in Asia, and other nations had driven them out. They, in the first century, they used the route between the north end of the Caspian Sea and the south end of the Ural Mountains, and they invaded several agricultural nations in Eastern Europe and occupied about 1 million square miles until about the 7th century. So, I mean, they did exist in that area, and then King Bulan, B-U-L-A-N, because of, they were morally degenerate and they were idolatrous and they worshiped the phallic symbol. I mean, they were pretty awful people. And so he decided, that they had to adopt, one of the religions, either Islam or Christianity or Talmudism or Judaism. And they chose to adopt Judaism as their new state religion. And so then the king imported rabbis from Babylon who opened synagogues and instructed all these people, right. Starting with you know, the richer class. But they were in Khazaria, and they practiced Judaism. And there is the 1954 Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 4, states, and they spell it different. They say, they spell it C-H-A-Z-A-R-S. And it says, a people of Turkish origin whose life and history are interwoven with the very beginnings of the history of the Jews of Russia, driven on by the nomadic tribes of the steppes and by their own desire for plunder and revenge. In the second half of the 6th century, the Khazars moved westward. The kingdom of the Khazars was firmly established in most of South Russia long before the foundations of the Russian monarchy, be about 855. And at this time, the kingdom of the Khazars stood at the height of its power and was constantly at war. And at the end of the 8th century, the king of the Khazars and his grandees, together with a large number of his heathen people, embraced the Jewish religion. Now, that's right out of the 1954 Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 4.
And so it's interesting, you know, when you talk about their warlike behavior and their aggression, you take a look at how the Zionists behave today, and at least this is my perspective, not a whole lot has changed in hundreds of years.
Yes. And when you look at the moral influence that they have, I mean, look who runs Hollywood.
Right.
And, we don't have to go much further than saying, well, than referencing Hollywood and some of the trash that comes out of that area.
I agree with that. And you know, it's interesting, Deanna, you and I spoke before. We had two other shows, and in one of the shows, we talked about Germany, we talked about, the Reich, and, Hitler was confronted with the very same issues, was he not, as far as looking at the decadence and
oh, yes.
the aggression. And I got into a conversation with some folks, I guess about, I don't know, a few weeks ago. And it, of course, they almost lost their minds, right? Because I had said that everything that we are faced with today that is emanating, like you said, out of Hollywood, the aggression, the violence, you know, the police forces in this country, many of them are trained in Israeli military and police tactics.
Exactly.
So when folks walk around and they can't understand why it is that we went from the police departments and the behavior and the code of conduct that they used to have, let's go back about 20, 30 years ago to what we're seeing today, I tell them, well, you have to take a look at where they're being trained.
Right.
Right? They just didn't get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go beat somebody. I mean, they're being trained in certain tactics. But my point being that, going back to what I was saying, that the Germans were facing the same exact disruptive force. And that was, in my view, in my research, a main driver, a main variable in why Adolf Hitler decided to expel them from Germany.
Exactly.
And, okay. I was going to say, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The Weimar Republic, it was just the things that were going on in the late 20s, Berlin was Sin City.
Right.
It was awful. And it's amazing. Some of those people actually left Berlin and went to Hollywood. And in your reference to the police, when you watch, well, there's a lot of cop shows on TV, and you repeatedly see them breaking into a person's home without knocking on the door. They just invade a person's home. And I think that, you know, SWAT teams, we're talking, you know, a lot of people. And I think that people are getting the idea, they're being programmed to accept the idea that it's perfectly fine for the police to barge into your home without knocking, without showing any kind of a search warrant or anything else.
Yeah, it's definitely conditioning.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, the media is used to condition, and you're absolutely right. There's all of these police shows, and in all of these police shows, I mean, what they depict is that basically what they're showing is that these police can do basically what it is that they want to do.
Sure.
That the means justifies the ends.
Right.
When I look at Zionism, I look at the Khazars, I see a repetitive type of behavior over history's timeline that hasn't changed an awful lot. And the only way that you're going to know that, of course, is if you do your research and your homework and you look into this. Otherwise, if you're just coming at it from a point in time, like right now, as an example, and you're taking a look at what's going on in the world, you have no reference point. There's no benchmark to look back at. And so therefore, this stuff probably doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. Or they just think that we just live in this spontaneously chaotic world. When in reality, when I look at it, I see a catalyst. And the catalyst are these Khazars and these Zionists, and they have been operating like this for hundreds of years.
Right.
And they have been infecting country after country after country. I forgot what the number was. I was watching one documentary once that it listed all the countries that they were expelled from, that they were told, you need to leave.
Right. I think there was something like 79 countries, but they were expelled 109 times because some countries expelled them more than once. And I recently did a program on Christopher Columbus, and there was an expulsion order in March of 1492, and they had until August 3rd to get out of the country. And he left. He had his crew board the ships, the three ships, at 11 p.m. the night before the final date that they were supposed to leave. It's very interesting that the Marranos, or the Jews in Spain, actually funded his expedition.
Okay, because I had heard recently, I can't say I read it, I was listening to a show and they said that Christopher Columbus was a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So is what you're saying, is that validating that he was Jewish?
I believe that he was Jewish.
Okay.
He claimed to his son's writings, he told his son that his blood was the blood of from Jerusalem. And there's all kinds of other, not confirmations, but, evidences that he was. And when you look at the way that he treated people, the natives, where he landed in the Caribbean, well, it was pretty awful.
Yeah.
I mean, he killed millions.
Right, right. And that's the thing. That's what I was saying before. They have this track record of just leaving, you know, just
carnage,
yeah. And, you know, and all the smut, the decadence, the pornography, the violence. It's so immoral. What you're seeing today is not new. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's not new. And it's a long embedded process that is part of a culture of people that have been carrying this type of behavior and this type of mentality for a very, very long time. And it's parasitical, in my view. It's infecting the minds of humanity, and we're paying the price for it.
Right. You know, getting back to Columbus, one of his big objectives was seizure of gold. I mean, when he got to the Caribbean, the natives, you know, there was a lot of gold around. There were a lot of treasures, mineral treasures and whatnot. And his objective was to seize all of this gold. I mean, when you look at it and you compare him with, for instance, the Rothschilds, and their seizure of gold, and their early objectives in California and among the natives, they were out for gold, which I've covered in one of my books, talking about what they did and the people that they hired. And even though they were working with what we now refer to as mercury, it didn't matter to them that this was dangerous and that the natives were going to die, because as far as they were concerned, as long as the natives worked, and so what if they died early? Well, we've got more natives that'll continue to work in the mines. It was called quicksilver at the time.
Right.
But, I mean, it's just amazing that their value system seems to be skewed, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think we're going to get into that a little bit more as we talk a bit about the Talmud, if you like to go there, because I think I'm going to say that I know a lot of people know nothing about it, and I'm not an expert on it by any stretch, but, you know, I've done enough digging to take a look at some of the passages that are contained in the Talmud, which should be very concerning to somebody who's not a Jew.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of people think that the Old Testament is the book that they refer to, particularly the first five books of the Old Testament. But their main book is the Talmud. And of course, it's not just one book. It is a continuing, you know, they continue to add to it. But some of the the way that they refer to Mary,
right,
as a harlot, and they say that Jesus is boiling in excrement in hell. I mean, Christians have absolutely no idea what is in the Talmud, and they also talk about about sexual abuse of children. I mean, it's just so vile to think of what they tolerate.
In the Sanhedrin would be, it's okay to cheat non-Jews.
Yes.
Jews have superior legal status.
Yes.
Jews may steal from non-Jews. Jews may rob and kill non-Jews. Jews may lie to non-Jews. I mean, it goes on and on.
Exactly.
And on, you know. And so then when the general population takes a look at it and wants to understand why it is that society is the way it is, why it conducts itself in a fashion that's immoral, that's unjust, well, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say that if the controllers are comprised of Talmudic Jews, well, then what you see in society today is the end result.
Exactly.
You know? And I'm probably going to catch a lot of grief for having this conversation, but you know, Deanna, I just got tired of dancing around the facts. I got tired of dancing around what is the catalyst. I mean, why is society the way it is, you know? And the thing is, nobody really wants to go there.
Sure. Well, we hear on the Jewish-controlled mainstream media that we should be worried about the Muslims, that we should be worried about Sharia law, when in fact it is really the Noahide laws that control and have been accepted by the United States. And this is a set of laws that were incorporated on March 20th, 1991 by President George H.W. Bush, a supposed Christian. He signed the bill into law. It was, and this was a process. Let's see, I'm just looking at some notes here. It was signed into law by the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives okayed it on March 5th, 1991. And the U.S. Senate okayed it on March 7th, without any knowledge or input by the people of the United States. They passed it, and it allows the U.S. government to legally kill Christians for the crime of worshiping Jesus Christ.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
I don't know anything about this, and I'm thinking to myself, I should know this, and I don't know it.
I'm going to send you a link.
Okay.
In the Skype window that talks about this. And this is from Bill Dannemeyer, who is the husband of Dr. Lorraine Day. He was a U.S. congressman from 1979 to 1992. And I think it would be profitable to go over this and to say, okay, what does this involve? Who did it? and what does it mean? And when you see the menorah, the giant menorah now displayed at the White House at Christmas time, and there's no manger scenes, then you have to say, what's the deal here? What's going on? And nobody's saying that. Nobody is saying, how come we can't have a menorah? I mean, there might be somebody saying it, but it certainly isn't publicized. But it is, the Noahide laws are literally, for the subtle elimination of Christianity, the elimination of all Christians, and the enslavement of all remaining Gentiles.
Okay, well, I have the link, and I'm going to take a look at it, and I'll put it in the show notes. This is very, very interesting.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Deanna, let me ask you this question. Going back a little bit here, we had said that the Zionists have their roots back to the Khazarian Empire. The Khazars adopted Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're saying, they're claiming that they have this right to the land out in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Now, someone might argue, or at least be thinking as they're listening to us, well, they must know that we're talking about the Zionists, that this is all a facade, right? That, you know, this is, they're not really indigenous, or that they don't have any linkage back, ancestral linkage back to the Middle East. So why there? I mean, why not someplace else? Why is it the Middle East? Why is it Israel, Jerusalem, Palestine?
Because that is the seat, the origination of Islam, as well as Christianity. And not only is it that, but it is also strategically located for military objectives. Where better to destroy Christianity than where it originated? In taking over this land, one of the objections to them taking over the land was that they would have jurisdiction over all of the Christian artifacts, over all of the original Christian churches. And it was just recently, maybe in the last 6 months, that one of the churches, I can't remember exactly, I went to that church. I was there in 99, but it was burned. And this was one of the original churches that was there shortly after, maybe from 325 onward. And they're destroying what is very valuable to Christians. And where better to do this than where it originated?
Now, their reason, Deanna, for wanting to eliminate Christianity and Islam, what's your perspective on that? Why destroy Christianity? Why destroy Islam?
I think that that the original destruction of Christianity didn't, it started with the socialization, meaning Marxism within the Christian churches. And this occurred in the seminaries initially. And I've talked about this in my book, about the socialization, making the churches Marxist, and which is the best way of doing it. You infiltrate them first, and I believe they've done that in Islam, in the Muslim religion, that they have infiltrated them, because the best way of destroying something is from within,
right,
rather than from without.
Okay, so they subvert from within.
Right.
And they just eat away at the core.
Right.
Until the whole thing, I guess, essentially collapses in on itself.
They don't actually collapse. You just change Christianity from something that it was. Christianity, you're supposed to fix the inside. And when they came in and made these churches Marxist, then you were supposed to go out and destroy evil people. So now you have a lot of churches in this country who are pro-war.
Right.
They say, oh, we need to destroy those evil people and we need to destroy the Germans or pick whatever enemy you want. Oh, we need to go and destroy those people. That was not what Christianity was about to begin with. It was about fixing the inner person, fixing yourself.
Now, you're absolutely right, because I know folks who are Christians and they're good people until they get to that point where they will then say, it's okay to eliminate those people over there because they don't believe in the God of the Bible, or they're heathens, they're non-believers, and there's this rationalization and there's this justification for killing.
Right.
And it's always been an eye opener to me. And I would actually get into conversations with them, and I would sometimes stop them and say, do you hear yourself? You're saying it's okay to go kill somebody else or take somebody else out. Just mind boggling to me. You mentioned earlier that, when we first started the conversation, that, you know, not all Zionists are Jews, that you have the Christian Zionists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And does this take the form of evangelicals?
Yes. Now, I was just kind of Googling, and I found an article. Israeli settlers burned church in Jerusalem. Now, this was in October of 2010, but they're talking about the settlers actually destroying a building. The church was built in Jerusalem in 1897, housed the Palestinian Bible College until 1947, but there was one that was just burned just recently. 200 Christian churches destroyed. Some of the destruction has been blamed on the Muslims. But I really think that the Jews are the ones that are actually destroying these churches.
What would make you lean that way?
Because they always blame other people for what they're doing themselves. I mean, that's just what they do.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because, we get these reports coming out of the Middle East, you know, with ISIS and stuff like that. And they're always destroying ancient monuments, landmarks,
right,
and stuff like that, you know. And, I guess we can roll into this either now or a little later, but a lot has fleshed out with Syria, what's going on in the Middle East, with Russia getting involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you my perspective on it. You may or may not agree, but what's going on there now with Putin going into Syria, he has really exposed, in my view, the Zionists.
He has, but I have an acquaintance in Moscow. He said that the country is totally run by the Jews, and I look at Putin as probably orchestrated opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see Putin as a savior, and besides that, he's in Russia. What does that have to do with people here in this country and their freedom? He's not going to come and save us. When you look at ISIS to begin with, it's a combination of the Mossad and the CIA, just
right,
like Al-Qaeda was. And when, you know, before you mentioned all of the buildings that were destroyed in Iraq and all the artifacts, the
looting of the museums.
I have a book about it, and it breaks my heart.
Yeah.
That all of this history is destroyed. And I mean, they've bombed Afghanistan. They've bombed Iraq back to the Stone Age. I mean, Iraq was a wonderful progressive country, and include Libya.
Right.
And destroyed the leaders of those countries and the people. Millions have been displaced, but when you want to destroy a people, you destroy their culture, either militarily or culturally. In this country, they are destroying our history, our value system, culturally. And in other countries, they are destroying it militarily. And that's what I meant when I said that the Jews needed help. They needed military help. They needed economic help. And what else did I, they needed,
well, and probably religious help too. I mean, to a certain degree.
Yes.
Right. The vilification of the other religions.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, my point with Putin though was, and I understand the point about controlled opposition.
Sure.
I do understand that. But what's interesting to me is Benjamin Netanyahu is going crazy. I mean, he looks like a lunatic these days. I mean, he even came out with a revisionist statement about how right. Hitler went. I mean, shouldn't he be arrested when he goes to Europe? I mean,
yeah.
And so I'm watching that and I'm thinking to myself, something's going on behind the covers. I mean, do they just want this guy out? Is he just too extreme? Is he just too over the top and out of control that maybe he's an impediment to their agenda? So, hey, look, it's time for you to get out of the way. I don't know. I'm just, those are rhetorical questions, by the way.
Sure.
You know, so I don't know. Something is going on there. And like I said, I do understand controlled opposition. We have it here in our country with, all of these candidates and so on, guys like Rand Paul. I think Ted Cruz is a little controlled opposition.
Absolutely. It's amazing. And they all love Israel.
They love Israel. Yep. And they go to the wall.
Yes.
Right. They pay their homage. They go to the Wailing Wall. I always say to people, I have this discussion. I'm not a very happy guy to bring to parties and have a conversation with.
I'm not either.
So maybe I'm mingling with the wrong people. But anyway, you know, I say, well, you know, it's interesting to me. All of our politicians go to the Wailing Wall and, you know, they pay their tribute, their homage. How come I never see Benjamin Netanyahu put his hand on the Jefferson Memorial and say what a great republic the United States is? You know, it's always going back, you know, who's your daddy type of thing. And, you know, if they don't get the blessings of the Zionists, then they're going nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. Right?
Right.
And I know I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but, this calls into the whole equation also, the dual citizenship that permeates our government.
Yes. We're the only country in the world that allows for dual citizens to hold office or to even, yes, to hold office.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
It is amazing, Deanna. You know, and when I talk to people about this also, first of all, you have to get them acclimated to understand what dual citizenship means. This is how almost hopeless it is when you speak to people. But once I get past that, it's like, you know, see spot run. Then you try to explain to them, you know, who some of these people are. And I actually pulled up a website earlier today, and it's called the American Freedom Party. I mean, I don't know much about them, so I'll say that up front. But they seem to have done a pretty good job of listing all of those folks, past and present, that were in very high-level government jobs, or they are current and past members of the Senate and the House of Representatives who are dual citizens. Mm-hmm. American, Israeli, or I should say Israeli Americans, because it's really Israel first, citizens. And I'm going to put that link in the show notes so folks can, you know, get their heads wrapped around that. But clearly when you have, I mean, the numbers are staggering. And when you have it to that magnitude, things are not going to go your way. And when I talk about your way, I'm meaning from the perspective of the Republic of the United States. It's just not going to go that way. It's going to be Israel's interests first, and everything else is second, if it's even considered.
Right. And it's been that way for some time.
It has been. I mean, I'm taking a look at some of these names. Some of the folks, let me just rattle some off so folks know, they'll recognize some of these names. You have Elliot Engel out of New York. We're talking about past members of the Senate. Steve Israel out of New York. Steve Kagan out of Wisconsin. We have Jerry Nadler out of New York. We have Steve Rothman out of New Jersey. Arlen Specter out of Pennsylvania. Debbie Wasserman Schultz out of Florida. Henry Waxman out of California. Anthony Weiner, how appropriate, out of New York.
Yes.
I mean, I just rattled off, and I'm telling you, I'm looking at a list here. There's got to be about 20 to 25 names there, and I didn't even look at the House of Representatives. There's another 20 to 25 there. And above that, there are 35 names. We're talking about very high-level jobs. Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, as an example.
Right.
The UN representative, the former UN representative, John Bolton, and so on. It's just unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. And we don't run our country.
We don't.
We don't.
I'm looking for a book. I have it in my Kindle collection of, well, almost 200 books. It's called The Jews of Capitol Hill.
Mm.
And it is a very, very good book to own. And it talks about the 200 Jewish people, members of Congress, that we really, when I bought this book, I thought, no kidding, really? There were that many serving in Congress? And if you look back at their, I covered this in my first book, the first book of my trilogy, they were complaining to the government as early as the 1840s about, well, being victims and, you know, please don't refer to us as that and do this and do that. And I'm thinking, whoa, these people really came in very, very early. And when you look at their influence, and it's kind of amazing, that they were actually Washington gave them their first in. And a lot of people don't realize how much influence he was when it comes to the Jews.
Is this because of their level of infiltration into Masonry?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
That's what my thought is, yep.
And because they infiltrated Freemasonry early on, because it was, it was just a really good thing to participate in. And certainly he was a Freemason.
Right.
And, but anyway, the Jews looked to him as somebody that allowed them to come in, to have equal rights. And I'm certain that it was probably because of the Masonic connection.
Yeah. And, going back to Germany. Hitler faced the exact same dilemma, right? He took a look at the government in Germany and he said that it was way, way too disproportionate, that there were way too many Khazars, Zionists, Jews in positions of, in government positions.
And not only in government positions, but in the theater, in the educational field, in every, theater, the media, medicine, education, in all of those areas.
Yeah.
It was top heavy with Jewish influence.
That's what I was saying before. It's the same dilemma we have today here.
Right.
The exact same thing. And that's why, folks, you know, I'm trying to be very tactful with this conversation because I don't want to get flamed with, you know, I'm an anti-Semite, I'm a Jew hater and all that stuff. Okay. Just, first of all, it doesn't do anything, okay? Those are just words. But I'm trying to take this so that, so Deanne and I could step you through this very logically in a calm way to explain what some of the problems are and why we have these problems. You know, and some people are going to say, well, what you're saying, Mike, is the Jews are the problem. So I guess that is what I'm saying.
I did find this book, and it's The Jews of Capitol Hill, A Compendium of Jewish Congressional Members. And it started quite early. It really did.
Oh, how early?
1st generation. Let me just scroll down. In the 1840s.
Okay.
Okay, the 1840s. We had, David Levy Yulee. Y-U-L-E-E. He lived from 1810 to 1886. He served in Congress from 1841 to 1851 and from 1855 to 1861. Now, I bought this book and I paid a lot of money, even as a Kindle. It was rather expensive, but I thought if you want to know what the problem is, you have to invest the money and you have to look at this, to see when it started. Because when you just look at things now, you say, oh yeah, there's probably 10 people in Congress or whatever. No. No, it started a long time ago. And when you look at the Panic of 1837, and, well, Jackson, Andrew Jackson in their pocket. People think that Andrew Jackson said, oh, I'm going to throw those bankers out and No. He and his Secretary of State actually made a deal with the Rothschilds in London that they would be be bankers for the United States. And that was Andrew Jackson under his watch. And they were the Rothschilds were the fiscal agents for the government. And, they did this. Okay. Niall Ferguson, who wrote a history, he was the biographer for the Rothschild family. He said Rothschild interest in the U.S. dates from the early 1830s when an opportunity arose to arrange the payment of £1 million owing to the treasury in Washington from France. This coup led to the Rothschilds replacing the Barings as the federal government's London agents. At the same time, Nathan and James Rothschild began their increased interest in American state loans and commercial finance, quote unquote. And so they started loaning money to the states as early as in the 1840s.
So 170 years ago.
Right. And you also find that the Treasury Secretary under Jackson, Levi Woodbury, was a Freemason. He received a letter from the Secretary of State, John Forsyth, dated August the 6th, 1834, as follows, and I quote, "I have the honor to acquaint you that, under the President's sanction, I have appointed N. M. Rothschild, Esquire, at London to be the banker of the United States in Europe after the close of the present year. Messrs. Barings of London and Mr. William Willink of Amsterdam have been advised of this arrangement and informed that their services in that character will then terminate, and have requested to pay over to Mr. Rothschild any balances that may remain in their hands to the credit of the United States on the 1st of January next," unquote. And so, getting back to this programming, you know, a lot of people say, oh gosh, wasn't Andrew Jackson just terrific? No. And that story, that myth about how he threw the bankers out did not appear or did not happen until like 1880. Some guy said, oh, I found the minutes for this meeting that Andrew Jackson had with a bunch of people from Philadelphia. And, you know, they went to see if he would renew the second bank because, you know, he closed the second bank and all of a sudden all those pension funds, were actually taken from the bank. There were a lot of people who received money, pensions from the bank, the second bank. He closed the bank. He put all that money into the banks of his friends. And so it was disastrous for the people.
Yeah.
Because they counted on this and, it was an awful thing.
So another less than accurate depiction of history.
Right. And he actually created, in 1837, the first financial recession in this country. His actions did that because he did close the bank. And it was not owned by the foreign bankers. It was under the jurisdiction of the Federal Reserve or the federal government, and he was the cause of the 1837 financial crises.
Interesting. So then, Deanne, if we fast forward, before we fast forward, and for the audience's benefit, because I'm trying to reach people that maybe are just new to the show and maybe mm-hmm. doing some research, mm-hmm. we talk about the Rothschilds, we talk about international banking. Are we talking about the Zionists? Are we talking about the Jews? Are we talking about the Khazars? Are they one and the same, or it depends?
Well, the Rothschilds were very interested in seizing Palestine. And in fact, it was the Rothschild family that set up the first community in Palestine. And this was in probably 1874. And so, yes, I mean, they own what you might say the country.
Yeah, and we can get into that a little bit more, I guess, because as we move along a timeline, we get up through, you know, World War One, and then we get to the Balfour Declaration, right?
Right.
And was that not addressed to Lord Rothschild?
Yes.
Which is amazing, right? I mean, the British government wrote to Rothschild,
yes,
and promised, yeah, promised the Rothschilds Palestine.
Right. They promised land that they didn't own. They had no right to even make that promise, but that is what they did. And then they had to use military power to go in and seize that land, destroy the Ottoman Empire. And essentially World War One destroyed most, well, if not all, except for Britain, all of the families, the royal families of Europe, who were all Christian dominated.
And the Jews at the time were known as Bolsheviks. Is that correct?
I think Marxist is a better term.
Okay.
Because we often think that the first Bolshevik revolution or the first Marxist revolution was in Russia, 1917, 1918. That is not true. The first Marxist revolution in the entire world, well, the first attempted ones, the first successful one was in this country. It was called the Civil War. And most of the, about 500,000 Marxists came over from Europe after the failure of the 1848-1849 Marxist revolutions in several countries in Europe. So they came over here, they fought in the North, for the North, and this, the Civil War, so-called Civil War, was the first successful Marxist revolution in the world.
Well, I guess a lot of people are not going to know that.
Well, when you look at what occurred after the fact, after that, when you look at the fact that about or at least 722,000 people perished, 7,222 people perished in this country as a result of that war. And when you look at where the battles were fought, there were only two battles that were fought in the North, Antietam and Gettysburg. Antietam was also known as Sharpsburg. Then when you look at the legislation following the war, and you see that corporations, that's when corporatocracy started. And when you're talking about corporations, you're talking about Jewish-controlled entities.
Now, does this factor in, let me ask this question, the Act of 1871, because that was right after the Civil War?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the Act of 1871 created this entity known as the District of Columbia.
Yep.
So let me ask this question, because I see this bantered around and talked about and discussed throughout the truth movement and the alternative media and research. The District of Columbia, I don't know, Deanna, if you know the answer to this, but if you don't, just say, Mike, I don't know. Is it or is it not a sovereign city-state?
It is. It all has to do with the collection of so-called income taxes and putting all of this, these economic obligations onto everybody in the United States, when in fact, you are not obligated to pay income tax, so-called income tax, unless you actually are working for the government.
Right.
And so it's all such a big farce.
Yeah, and now with the District of Columbia, and I'll give you my perspective on this, people today will complain, well, they're not paying attention to the Constitution, they're trampling all over it and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
So is that because the District of Columbia, being a sovereign city state, what it governs by is admiralty and maritime law, the law of the sea?
Somewhat, but when you're talking about the Constitution and them not paying attention to the Constitution, well, the Constitution was created by an elite group of people behind doors. And when you look at who created it and the fact that it actually supplanted the Articles of Confederation, which really should be still valid. And under the Articles of Confederation, the states had freedom. They had autonomy And the states got together and they decided, okay, we'll create these articles. And so then you have the Constitution, which supplanted that, which gave a lot of power to the elite. And I've done 100 pages or so talking about this and talking about, what I refer to as the great American Republican experiment. And even the word republic is a Marxist term. And when Lincoln, declared war on the South, and he used a false flag in order to do that, when he declared war on the South, it was because they were fighting for states' rights. It was never about slavery. The North would never have gone to war if it had been about slavery. Slavery came into being, they used the justification of slavery a year after the war started. When you're looking at the Constitution as, well, I don't know. I mean, they haven't adhered to it for a long time.
But don't the Jews also have their, I mean, aren't they neck deep in the slave trade historically?
They started it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They started it. And what's so interesting about the slavery is that the North emancipated the slaves in the South. It was just like the Balfour Declaration. Okay. They said, okay, we're going to give you this land, even though they don't own it. They had no jurisdiction over it. The North was declaring to the South, okay, we're releasing all these slaves, but they didn't release the ones that they owned. The people who owned slaves in the North, that didn't apply to them. It only applied to the slaves in the South. But slavery actually began in the North. The Jews owned the ships. They owned the markets. They were part of the triangular trade, with sugar and, rum and slavery. And getting back to Columbus, Columbus was educated as far as the sugar trade. He knew all about the sugar trade because he went to Madeira. He knew about slavery. He had an education and experience in sugar and trading with sugar and slavery. So what he did when he arrived in the Caribbean, was something that he was already experienced in.
And sugar back in those days was referred to as white gold.
Right. It was the very first, narcotic drug that people use.
If we go back, Deanna, for a second, because this is a great conversation. I love speaking with you.
I like talking with you all.
If we go back just for a second to the District of Columbia, if we say that it is a sovereign city state, then could we not make the argument that it is a foreign occupying force?
Sure. Sure. And then you also have to consider the original 13th Amendment, because the original 13th Amendment actually said that lawyers could not function in Congress.
No titles of nobility.
Exactly.
Right. And it disappeared.
Yes.
Just disappeared.
Yes.
I did a show on that, I guess about almost 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of research into that. I'm so glad you brought it up. And you know, I can only get like 200 views on that video.
Really?
People just, they don't, it's almost like they don't care. You're trying to bring stuff out. You're trying to educate them. You're trying to get them to wake up. And you can't get them to wake up. In fact, the title of the video was, "Is the United States a Corporation?"
It is. It absolutely. And right now, Obama is the exec.
He's the president of U.S.
Yes.
Inc. Yep.
Yep.
And you can't get people to understand that either. And, you know, because once you start to understand that it's a corporation and they're operating in a sovereign city state, then you can mm-hmm. really start to understand why it is nothing goes our way.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
It doesn't go our way because they're not interested in the welfare and the well-being of the populace. They only
right.
care about themselves, and they care about, it's an elite class, and they're just taking everything for themselves. And You know, and I just wish more people would spend the time to grab on to these topics. I know you do a lot of shows and I do my shows. There's many people doing some great work out there. I just wish the audience would spend more time listening to those shows and getting themselves smarter about how things work.
Okay, so the corporation, which calls itself the United States, has a private constitution.
That's
it
right.
It is their constitution. It is not our constitution. It is theirs. Now, and also when you consider the fact that it is the mother corporation for all other corporations in the United States, and including, okay, each city is a corporation, each county is a corporation, each school district is a corporation, all the churches, most of the churches, probably 95% of the churches are corporations. That is why they are all accommodating the government. And when you think, okay, your church is a corporation, I thought it was a church. I mean, how can it be a corporation? Because we find now churches are participating in the drive in Bill Gates's objectives of vaccinating, injecting people with poison.
Yeah.
That there are churches that are giving him millions of dollars for his efforts.
Yeah.
And what is that all about?
Yeah.
Yes, what is that all about?
It's so corrupt.
It's a big bait and switch kind
yeah.
of thing.
Well, I'm glad we're having this conversation too, because trying to get people to understand that it's a corporation. And what I tell them is that it says it's the Constitution of the United States. It's of the corporation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not for the United States, which is for the people. It's of the United States. So it's the
exactly.
corporate constitution. And that's why they don't pay any heed to it, because that document basically is a think of it in terms of their guiding principles, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a document that secures the rights of the people. They don't care about the people. The people are collateral and assets against whatever it is they want to do.
And absolutely.
Through taxation. So they dig themselves a big hole. They just tax you more. It's all they do.
Right.
Right. So let me just say, there was another question I had for you. And, oh, I know what it was. Going back to, we talked about the Act of 1871, and then there was the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that put the banks, the central banks, the Federal Reserve in control, essentially. The country went bankrupt in 1933. Am I right with that?
Yes.
And that's when we had the confiscation of gold. Shortly after that, World War II ended. And with the ending of World War II, the United Nations handed Palestine over to the Jews.
Under Truman.
Mm-hmm. Under Truman, right.
A Freemason,
33.
Mm-hmm.
He was the 33rd president also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Coincidence?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Nope. Nope.
They love their numbers.
They do.
And I also read that Truman had become, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you don't know about this, but he had become a little disillusioned with the Jews, and he had altered the document, I guess. I hope I get this right. That said that they wanted the Jewish state, and he scribbled that out and wrote the State of Israel. Oh, where did I read that? I'm probably going off on some tangent, a rabbit hole we probably don't need to go down. But let me ask this about Truman. Was he paid off? I had read that he was paid off $2 million to make sure that that agreement, handing Israel over to the Jews post-World War II. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. FDR literally redid the State Department and just brought in so many Marxists. I mean, they were communists.
Okay. And these were predominantly Jews.
Yes. Right. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right. I want to make that clear, because when people hear the word communist, they really don't go any deeper than that. I want them to understand when we talk about communism, we're talking
about... It is Jewish.
Right.
Judaism is communism, and communism is Judaism. That's just the way it is. And there's also something else that FDR started. He started the Administrative Procedures Act, that he, he initiated that on February 16, 1939. And Truman took over from there. And what that did was totally restructure the government. Absolutely, totally restructured it. So that you had more bureaucracy, and the president also had more authority to do a lot of executive orders. And that came from the FDR administration and then completed by Truman so that they could, have more power. They placed more power in the executive branch rather than in the other two branches of the government. In 1948, according to John F. Kennedy, many of Truman's supporters abandoned him because he supported the Morgenthau Plan and other questionable issues. On his whistle-stop campaign train during the presidential race, an avid Zionist delivered a suitcase containing $2 million in cash, which gave him the financial boost he needed to win. Truman believed, as a result of the Holocaust, that the oppressed Jews deserved a homeland. The British relinquished the problem of a shared Arab-Jewish state to the UN on April 2, 1947, because of Jewish terrorism in Palestine. Truman instructed a reluctant State Department to endorse the UN's partition plan on November 29, 1947. At midnight on May 14, 1948, Israel's provisional government announced the new State of Israel. On that same day, like Roosevelt's recognition of the Soviet government, Truman officially recognized the Zionist government in Palestine against the advice of many people. He did not tell leading State Department officials, who became angry when they heard about it. On May 15, 1948, the Arab states responded by invading Israel, which began the first Arab-Israeli war.
Yep, and I'm looking at a map on my screen right now. What Palestine looked like in 1947, yes. And then the partition plan in 1947, which is what you just spoke about. And then you take a look at what has happened to Palestine since 1949 to present. And, you know, even today, Palestine, folks, is not contiguous. The Israelis have essentially chopped it up so that you really can't move in Palestine. It's essentially an outdoor concentration camp.
Indeed.
And, it's really unbelievable, and folks need to get their heads wrapped around that too. I mean, I've spoken to people and they say, well, it says in the Bible. I'm like, oh, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop it. So many people have been killed, murdered, massacred, displaced.
Yes.
Because of what's going on over there. It is a crime. I don't know. Do you know Max Egan at all?
Yes. Okay. I don't know him, but I know of him.
Well, Max did a pro-Palestinian presentation, speech, and afterwards he was pretty severely beaten.
You're kidding.
No, I'm going to read it here. It says, activists, it's on my blog, activist, humanitarian radio host, and outspoken advocate for Palestine rights, Max Egan of thecrowhouse.com, was viciously attacked after delivering a pro-Palestine speech at the 2015 Freedom Summits in Byron Bay on October 23rd. This is in Australia. The attack came from nowhere, he said. I had just left my favorite eating place and was attacked from behind by quite a large individual. Egan took several blows to the back of the head and 4 or 5 kicks to the torso and suffered some bruising and 2 cracked ribs. He's now recovering at home and on medication to deal with the pain. He says this attack has only served to reinforce his commitment. Max says, now I have a tiny taste of what it feels like to be a Palestinian. All this attack has done is serve to strengthen my resolve. It shows me the powers that believe they be are running scared because they know the wheels are falling off the slavery system they are running. Due to this assault, from this point forth, my message will be louder and even more direct.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. See? You know, so this, I wanted to bring this in because this is goes right along with what we've been talking about. We're talking about the aggression and that type of behavior, and here you go.
Right. Well, I mean, the Jewish paramilitary, they organized Haganah, Haganah, Ergun orchestrated, which is a terrorist organization. And in fact, it was the terrorist organization that Matilda Krim, who was a good friend, quote unquote, of Lyndon B. Johnson. She had worked for Ergun, and her first husband was a member of Ergun. But anyway, she was the first person that Johnson talked to after the war started in 1967. But anyway, Ergun orchestrated the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem on July 22nd, 1946, and the Deir Yassin massacre with the Stern gang's help on April 9th, 1948. I mean, these people are terrorists. And, I'm sure you've heard of Jabotinsky.
Yes.
And in 1939, he wrote, "The Arabs must make room for the Jews in Eretz Israel. If it was possible to transfer the Baltic peoples, it is also possible to move the Palestinian Arabs." I mean, they just, okay, get them out of the way. If they don't move, we'll just kill them. And they have destroyed 500 towns. They took over all the orchards. I mean, to hear them talk, place was empty. They don't view them as human beings.
Right. They don't consider them to be human beings. They're animals.
Right.
Subhumans.
Exactly.
It's really unbelievable. It really is. But Deanna, I know I've kept you here for a long time. You've been so gracious with your time. But let me ask you this last question to get your perspective on this. What's your view of Donald Trump? A lot of Americans are, you know, on the sidelines with their pom-poms jumping up and down. Do you view him making anything better, or is it going to be the same old, same old?
He would not be successful in Manhattan unless he had a lot of Jewish friends. He has a Jewish daughter. He loves Israel. He feels that Israel should succeed, and he would bomb anybody that he was told to bomb.
Yeah. Well, I agree that he has a lot of Jewish influence, Jewish associates. I'm not predicting a lot of change, if you will.
Exactly.
I find it interesting, though, that he is talking a lot of truth movement type of speak.
I think that maybe the truth movement, the so-called truth movement, has become large enough that the people who are running for office need to accommodate us. They need to try and win some of us over.
Yeah.
And it's, okay, it's the same as the people who talk about ending abortion. And this has been going on since 1973. You hear all these Republicans talking about, oh, we've got to end abortion. And then people go out and they vote for them. They have no intention of ending abortion.
Yeah.
They're just using it as a way of getting votes. Politicians lie. Okay, they lie to get votes. They have no intention of actually following through.
Well, we can point to Barack Obama for that. I mean, we could talk
yes.
any president, but he, to me, was the most blatant. I go back to some of the speeches he made during his first term when he was running for president, and it's astounding what he lied his way through.
The Jewish bankers bought him before he ever became a politician in Illinois. He met with them in New York, and basically sold out. And they are the ones that funded his campaign in Illinois, and they've been funding him ever since. And people say, oh, he's a Muslim. He's not a Muslim. His mother was a Jew. He's a communist. His father was not some guy from Kenya.
Right.
But he was a Marxist, a communist.
He's been tucked in with the CIA for a long time.
Oh, yes. I did an article talking about his CIA connections. And I did this, probably in 2010, I want to say. And in fact, I was chatting with Reverend Manning, James Manning.
Yep.
And he is quite a character. He called, what does he call him? He calls Barack Obama, oh my goodness, what does he call him? A two-legged, oh, I can't remember, but it's not very nice. Obviously, it's not very nice. but he, in fact, I was going to go out and, to appear with, Manning, Dr. Manning. And, he was actually doing a treason trial for Obama, and he scheduled this for May 14th through the 19th in 2010. And he wanted me to come to the court and whatnot. But anyway, according to Dr. Manning, Obama was enrolled at a very pricey Occidental College in Los Angeles, California in 1979, where the CIA recruited him in 1980. And he was a dope head. He was a C student. He was a member of the Marxist Club at Occidental. And he transferred from Occidental to Columbia, where he was then under the jurisdiction of Brzezinski, who was also, and we know that, well, we know,
yeah,
it's a big new Brzezinski.
Forget it. Yeah, right.
I mean, he's had ties to the CIA since 1959, and he was at Columbia.
Well, he formed the Trilateral Commission, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, this is amazing. It's amazing. But yeah, I mean, Obama's, he's the president of the corporation, okay?
Right.
That's what he is.
Yep. And I tell folks, because it's a corporation, they're beholden to the board of directors, to investors, to stakeholders. And,
yeah.
Right. I mean, like any other corporation, that's who they are beholden to. And, the population, the average Joe and Jane Blow out there, you are not a stakeholder. You are not an investor. And you are not part of the board of directors. So that's why you get the short end of the stick every time.
Right.
Every time. So.
And you know, it's interesting that all of Obama's, passport records.
Yeah.
Went missing. And, very interestingly, because they would have shown, how he was traveling, as a part of the CIA. And, anyway, it's just very interesting.
Well, look, all anybody knew about him when he got elected was he was born in Hawaii. He was a community organizer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a one-term senator out of Illinois, if he even mm-hmm. completed that, right? He didn't even finish his one term,
mm-mm.
right? And then he became president.
Right.
How does that happen?
How does that happen? Seriously, how does that happen?
Oh, my God. And nobody thinks through this. Nobody sits there and says, how did that happen?
Because he's a schmoozer, and because he's a liar, and he's persuasive to some people.
Well, and the thing is, he's connected, and he's being backed, and he's being pushed, and he's part of the agenda.
Sure. Yeah.
You know?
And when you look at the people who funded him in 2008, people have been killed to silence them.
Yeah.
The person who was talking about who scrubbed the passport records to erase any mention of his CIA activities and personal information, the guy got killed. He was murdered. Someone shot him in the head. They executed him.
Is this fixable? I mean, I take a look at what's going on, and I take a look at the depths of the subversion and the rabbit hole and how deep it goes. And it goes really, really deep. You know, all the pedophilia, the rituals, the everything. It's just, it's unbelievable. The level of evil that is just engulfed the world, especially this country in the West. I mean, do you see a way out of this? I mean, how does this end?
Not well.
I try to keep optimistic about it. You know, I'll always fight the good fight, Deanna. You know,
sure.
I'm going to stay in there. I know you are too.
Sure.
And, but every once in a while, I take a step back and I take a look around and I think to myself, wow.
Right.
We're in deep trouble.
We are in very deep trouble. There are things that we can control and there are things that we can't control. And we just have to choose to control those things that we can, and, you know, personal decisions that we make.
Yeah.
And we don't need to let the evil that surrounds us make us evil or make us cave in. Our homes can be our sanctuary. The decisions that we make, will stand with us. I mean, if we make the right decisions, well, like Max Siegman, he's not going to quit. He's going to continue to fight the good fight. That's what we all are trying to do. That's what we'll do. And that will stand as a testimony to us, to our righteousness, to our intentions, to our good intentions, to...
No, exactly. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
We have to just keep marching forward.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
Just keep pushing on.
We can't give up.
No.
That's just not, and it's not in our makeup. Once you know the truth, there's no turning back. There's just no turning back.
That's the thing. Once you know the truth, you're exactly right. You do not go back to the way things were.
Right.
You just can't. You're looking at it. I mean, I don't even watch the news anymore, but every once in a while when I take a peek at it, it's like I'm on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
You can just see all of the lies and deception coming out of the mouths of the puppets that are reading teleprompters.
Mm-hmm.
Then, again, like I said before, you step back and you think about all the people that are listening to that and believing every ounce of it.
Right.
So, people, turn off your TV sets.
Yes.
Stop absolutely. Watching that stuff. All right, Deanna, again, thank you so, so much.
Well, thank you.
All right, Deanna, have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes another Sage Akwe interview, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. Links to my guests' websites and social media are included in the show notes below. And as always, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and visiting the blog. You can get to the blog by typing in sageofquayradio.blogspot.com or simply head over to our hub website at sageofquay.com. Also, if you get a moment, please visit laborofloveMusic.com to listen to my album, Leaving Dystopia. And remember, live in truth and always serve creation. It's really that simple. See everyone next week. Be safe, enjoy, and God bless.